When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, I'm Andrea Blythe, co-host of New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, we're speaking with Mary Soon Lee about her book, The Sign of the Dragon, which recently won a 2021 Elgin Award. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Mary Soon Lee was born and raised in London, but now lives in Pittsburgh. She writes both fiction and poetry and has previously won both the Riesling Award and Elgin Award. Her two latest books are from the opposite ends of the poetry spectrum. Elemental Haiku contains haiku for each element of the periodic table, and The Sign of the Dragon is an epic fantasy with Chinese elements. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I just really loved The Sign of the Dragon, and I'm just so excited that we got honored with an award as well.
Thank you. I was really pleased too.
So I always like to kind of start off with writers' origin stories. So I would love to know how you first connected to writing and starting your path as a writer and a poet.
Well, it took a while. So I began by thinking I was going to do a STEM type career. I studied mathematics at college, and then I did a computer science 1 year postgraduate course. And then later I did an MSc in astronautics and space engineering. And at that point, I accompanied my husband to the United States. And while I was waiting to get a work permit, the Gulf War started, and the job I had been going to go to said, wait for the work permit office in Boston to reopen because it had closed. And while I was waiting, I started writing, and then I found that I liked it. So that's how it began. I didn't write much poetry until after the birth of my second child. And at that point, it was very hard to get any free time. And I discovered that it was much easier to write a poem than to write a story. I mean, much quicker. I could complete it in mere hours.
Yeah, for sure. So your first two books were fiction books, right? Short story collections?
Correct, yes. Because I began by writing short stories, and the poetry came later.
Yeah, so you mentioned that writing poetry was easier in terms of like time constraints, but what was your experience of like transitioning from fiction to poetry in terms of figuring out craft?
Well, I had read quite a lot of poetry ever since I was a child, but I haven't been taught either fiction writing, prose writing, or poetry writing since partway through high school. The last 2 years of high school, I only did math and science, which is a very quintessentially British thing that you specialize early. So I was in a similar place to when I began writing fiction, in that I'd read a lot of fiction. It was time to just try writing it. And similarly for the poetry. I was in a writer's group that I ran, and one of the other writers had brought in some poetry, and I'm guessing his feedback was insightful. I've always considered it to have been insightful. But, you know, that was it. I didn't attend a course on poetry. So,
yeah, I mean, you said you've read a lot of poets. So are there particular poets that like you turn to when you're looking for inspiration and how to approach a piece or that sort of thing?
Not so much. I don't typically read to directly and immediately get ideas. They feed into a sort of longer term process. I do sometimes look at writing prompts, and there's a book called The Daily Poet, and I'm trying to remember the author's names. I'm blanking on it. I feel like it's something like Agadon is one of their surnames.
Kelly Russell Agadon?
Maybe, yes. And maybe Martha, and then I'm blanking. But they have a prompt for each day of the year, and I often do dip into it, not necessarily at the right date that I'm on. I mean, it's October and I might look at something from May. And sometimes that just sends me off in a certain direction. And other times I ignore it. Yes, I should have made a note of things like that so I could tell you who had written that book.
That's all right. It's always hard to remember when you're like on at the moment. So I totally understand. I just looked it up. It's The Daily Poet by Kelly Russell Agadon and Martha Solano.
There you go. That's it.
So for anybody who would like to look into it, yeah.
I found it quite helpful. I mean, other than that, there are definitely poets that I think influenced me and influenced this book in particular, but it was very indirect. Do you want an example? When I was a child, I read a book by Elizabeth Barrett Browning called Aurora Lee. And it is a novel-length narrative poem. And it was the first time I had realized that you could essentially tell a novel-length story in poetry in English. I'd been exposed to the Odyssey and the Aeneid and so on. But those weren't in English. And by the time I read them in English, you know, the poetry was mostly lost in translation. And so this was kind of a revelation to me to read Aurora Leigh years ago. And although I didn't consciously think about it when I began writing The Sign of the Dragon, I think it was in the back of my mind just letting me know that it's possible to write a very long poetry project that tells a story.
Yeah, sometimes it's so interesting how some of those like childhood or years ago things that we experience can continue to have an effect on us later down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So speaking of your most recent book, The Sign of the Dragon, it is really such a great epic story. And I would love to talk a bit about how this book came into being and how you kind of got started with it.
Well, I got started with it back in 2013. I had been writing mostly poetry since the birth of my second child. And for some reason, which I still don't understand why, I had been writing mostly mainstream poetry. And in the summer of 2013, I decided to try writing some fantasy poetry. And most of my short stories prior to that, years earlier, had been science fiction or fantasy. So I wrote a few fantasy poems, and I found that it was a really wonderful experience. I felt much freer, I guess, because the mainstream poems had been mostly about my life or my actual opinions or something like that. And suddenly I was able to write about almost anything. And one of the first almost anything poems I wrote was a poem about a young prince whose father has died, and he's sent to a mountain where they're going to choose the new king. But he's the youngest prince, so he's expecting one of his brothers to be chosen. And I wrote it as a standalone poem, and F.J. Bergman at Starline very kindly published it as a standalone poem. But after I had finished it, I thought about the boy in the story, and I found I wanted to write some more poems about him. So I wrote a few more poems, and then I wrote a few more poems, and somewhere in there, I'm not sure whether, you know, I had written a dozen poems or two dozen poems telling his story, I realized I was going to write a whole lot of poems about him. And then over the next several years, I did. Eventually, I completed it.
Yeah. So as you were kind of like one poem kind of built on the other, did you find yourself having to like just start planning out the structure of this greater work to try to make sure that it had a sense of cohesion and where the holes might be and that sort of thing?
I made a ton of notes, and they were, you know, nearly all the poems in my version of it, it tells you the month or even the day that it happened and the year that it happened and where it happened. And, you know, I kept notes on all kinds of things so I could just keep track of it, much as you might if you were writing a novel. And it was more than two dozen poems in somewhere, because I was writing poems that were fairly standalone in the beginning. And then I began telling a story and I began working out pieces of the arc of the story. And well before I got to the end, I knew the basic shape of the story. I mean, it's not a romance, but if it was a romance, I knew that it was going to be, you know, the two of them would end up together. So it's not a romance, but for the kind of story it is, I knew the basic shape. And then it was a question of completing it. And I wrote, after a while, I was writing pieces of the story that were at different points within the story. You know, I would write a poem from the middle and then a poem from far on in the story. The first 60 poems got published as a book, a shorter book by Dark Renaissance Books in 2015, as it was titled Crowned. And so those were more or less frozen. I only made a few changes to those ones, but everything else I kept slotting in poems or moving poems around or adding extra, you know, just fiddling with the existing poems.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an interesting process to me, the idea of writing an epic collection in this way, because each of the poems kind of, they pretty much feel pretty complete in and of themselves. Like I could almost see them standing alone while being a part of the larger story. And I'm wondering, like, did you find yourself cutting or removing poems or re-adding poems?
I removed a few poems. I added a lot. I mean, as in, I kept inserting things. You know, I would realize that I wanted to have another poem about a certain character. So there are poems about, you know, the king's cat and the king's cleaning woman and lots of his guards and his enemies and so on. And in some cases, I would realize, oh, I think I'd like another poem about the cleaning woman. And then I would think, so what will that poem be about? You know, because she could have seen different pieces of the story, or it could be tangential to the whole main story. It isn't like a regular book in that it does show some things such as wars in a fair amount of detail. But even then, it doesn't necessarily show the main battles. It just has little pieces that I've decided I just felt like writing about.
Yeah, I kind of I like the way the these little side characters kind of add a richness to the world that you might not be able to get in a standard novel, because like you said, like they wouldn't necessarily fit in a standard narrative format.
Thank you. I found it was very it was suited to what was happening to me at the time, because by breaking it into individual poems, I could finish a poem and then mostly not think about it while I was hanging out with my children. I mean, I did think about it. I, in fact, thought about it as I was brushing my teeth and so on. But it was in the background and I was able to pay more attention to them. Whereas I know if I had tried to write a regular novel, I would have always been, you know, expecting to write the next chunk. But this was the piecemeal nature of it made it manageable for my lifestyle at that time. I don't know how writers manage if they have young children and, or even not so young children, slightly older children, and maybe a real job, and they're writing a novel. I mean, I greatly admire all the people who've succeeded in doing that.
Same. So another aspect of your book is because this is epic fantasy, it feels very much has this classic kind of mythic quality to it. Like the stories of King Shao remind me of the legends of like King Arthur, where you have this noble king who is trying to do his best in the world despite all the challenges that keep getting thrown at him, whether he likes it or not. Mm-hmm. And so I would love if you kind of talked about these kinds of heroic noble characters and how you kind of make your character in particular like more human and not just this like, you know, shining icon figure that can feel flat without that sense of humanity.
Well, my family read a lot of the poems as I was writing this, and they basically thought that Zhao was too perfect. And I mean, on the one hand, I agreed with them, and on the other hand, I didn't want to change him, and I didn't feel he was in fact perfect. He was just always trying to do the right thing. He wasn't necessarily immensely brave. He just, when it came to it and he had to make a choice, he would do the thing that he thought was the correct thing to do. And I guess it was in some sense, you know, a wish fulfillment that there might be a leader who was tremendously ethical or something. Another aspect of the book also came without design, but I think in retrospect it was almost inevitable, because I was just pulling things out, I guess, of my subconscious. So it ended up that there are a lot of Chinese influences in the book, which I think comes from my father, who was ethnically Chinese. And then there are some Celtic ones. That's a secondary thread. And my mother was Irish. And although I grew up in London, she kept her Irish passport all her life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she could speak Gaelic and so on. So, yeah. So things come from somewhere, even when you don't directly try and pull on them, they just end up surfacing anyhow.
Yeah, it all just comes out of the mix of experiences and things we read and of our lives. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking a bit about, I love novel and poems, and I love kind of epic poetry in general, so like the classic Greek kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was curious on your thoughts on the line between prose and poetry and where narrative kind of blends with poetry.
Yes.
And how it blurs.
Yes.
And like, do you feel like that line between prose and poetry kind of shifted as you were writing this book?
Well, I think if there is a line, the line exists. I'm sure there were points where I felt I definitely crossed it, and it was, I was writing prose poetry or prose. And I do think a lot of my poems are very close to prose. I mean, in this book in particular, you know, I have written, you know, a book of haiku, and obviously those have a form throughout. But I think that for me, what remains poetry is something to do with condensing something large and encapsulating it in a poem. I do think there are plenty of novels where the prose is very poetic. I don't write much rhymed and metered poetry, though there is a little bit even in this book. When I was writing it first, I didn't think about it. In retrospect, I look back at some of the poems. You know, even the first poem, you know, which did well, you know, it won an award and so on. I look at it and I think, I don't know why I made the line breaks, you know, why I felt I could put the line breaks where I put them, you know, and I look at it with a very critical eye now, but I also know it's pretty much set in steel because it's been published fairly widely. So that's done, it's done. But how, you know, there are other places. As I was writing it, I realized I had, without intending to, started using sort of Homeric tags for some of the characters to a little extent. You know, so for instance, the first enemy that King Zhao faces is, I refer to him as the Red King, red-haired, red-handed in war. And sometimes I just use part of that. And if I were writing the book from scratch, I would have thought that out in advance and used it more consistently and probably more than I did. But again, you know, I guess I was learning as I was going what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. So so I don't know. It's really strange looking back at my own writing. There are things about it I can't help loving, and those things are normally to do with the characters because I'm very attached to the characters. But when I look at the craft aspect of it, I tend to see the things that I wish were more like, I don't know, more like the poets that I've admired, or more like the poets that I'm not like. So for instance, you know, when a poet that I think I'm not like, but whose poetry I like is Dylan Thomas, because there the sound and the rhythm and so on, it's so perfect. And I, you know, I can sort of wish that my poetry were like that, and I can to some extent move it a little closer to it, but I can't be Dylan Thomas.
Right, we can only be the writers that we are.
Mm. Yes.
So that it kind of makes me think of like, do you believe it's true based on your experience with, say, the first poem, that a piece it can only be a piece is never finished; it can only be abandoned. I've heard that said by some famous poet.
Yes. Well, I definitely feel that my pieces are almost never completely right. They are abandoned, and they are, or maybe abandoned is the right word. I say to myself, it is what it is. And this is, if I move it any further, I'm going to break it. I did read Ursula Le Guin had a comment in one of her many books on writing, or maybe it was in an interview, but about, you know, if you revise too much, you obviously some revision is helpful, but if you revise too much, you can lose whatever it was that was the essential nature of the thing. So I do feel with some of the things, particularly the things that I'm not even really sure where they came from, I can try and tweak it, but if I change it too much, then it loses whatever it was meant to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, we were talking about how the book as a whole, like you kind of did more additions and subtractions, but when you're working on an individual poem, do you find yourself, do the pieces look very different from when they started?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. Sometimes they come out very close to the end product, and sometimes a lot of rearranging happens as the poem is being written. And sometimes between a poem being written and it being published, I will return to it and do a major revision that happened, you know, like a month or 2 months or even longer. When I'm writing poetry in general and I'm sending it out, if a poem is rejected, which alas happens quite a lot, and it comes back, I look at it again, and sometimes I realize I'd like to change something, and sometimes it's just a word, but sometimes it's a significant change. Like I don't like the ending, or I wish it were shorter, or I wish it were longer. And so sometimes poems do get major revisions after I've written them, but normally once they're published, I let it go.
So speaking of some of these individual poems, would you like to read one of the poems from the book?
I would certainly be happy to. It's very difficult because there are so many different types of poems. Anyhow, I tried to pick one that sort of works by itself, and you or anyone will be able to tell. I didn't pick one of the rhymed poems. It's on this edge between poetry and what everyone would consider poetry and what only people of a wide-ranging definition of poetry would consider poetry. And it takes place early on in the story. The main character, King Zhao, is 17 years old. He recently became the king, and he recently fought and won his first war. So here we go. Stables. In the stables, King Zhao found himself again, or found the man he might have been if he had never been crowned, never gone to war, never led other men to their deaths. Half an hour at a time, squeezed between meetings and training exercises, the stables secured by his guards. Only Kayat, once his stable boy, inside to watch him groom Mitya or Pika or Narsen or Roma, to sit beside him on the feed sacks, breathing leather, manure, dust, the scent of the horses. Zhao's words already spent on rice farmers, ministers, ambassadors, advisors, on irrigation, taxation, alliances, strategy, so that sometimes he had no more than a handful of words for the boy. Kayat, younger even than Zhao, turned 15 that autumn, but sometimes they spoke at length about the horses, both Zhao's own mounts and the others in the stable, about the condition of the pastures, the chafing of a girth, a horse off its feed, while Kayat rubbed oil into the saddles, asking nothing of Zhao then or later. Zhao listened more than he spoke, received more than he gave, though he asked nothing of boy or horses beyond their company, but boy and horses alike offering him, unasked and without restriction, their hearts. The poem is over. I did wonder, you know, if I should pick a poem that's more obviously poemy, but I persuaded myself it would be a cruel deception, since only a few of them are obviously poemy, rhyming poems, and I would just mislead people.
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to this poem, because I was thinking, listening to you hear it aloud, like, it's free verse, so, like, it doesn't have that very obvious distinction of poetry, of like rhyming or metered poetry. But what it has is a very visual language and a sense of, there is kind of a rhythm to it that its own, that kind of matches this quieting down of this king trying to find some peace after having gone to war.
Thank you. I mean, some of the poems, I think, do have a rhythm. They don't normally have a meter. There are only a few of them that have a meter or a rhyme. Yeah. Thank you.
I was, that was definitely one of the things that I enjoyed about it. It's very accessible from the point of view, because it's that line between narrative and poetry is just so interesting to me, especially in these kind of epic novel and poems kind of works. Mm. And I enjoyed that in this work, that there, it still felt like poetry to me, even though it was very narrative focused.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I've read several of the, in English translation, I hasten to add, several of the Chinese classics over the last few years. And these are books from hundreds of years ago that were considered, held up at the, for hundreds of years as being, you know, the premier works of Chinese literature. And what was interesting to me was that they all contain poetry, often extensive amounts of poetry, and the translators have sometimes omitted poems and sometimes tried to translate them as poetry and sometimes translated them, but not poetically. But it was interesting just that the books themselves were a mixture of, you know, regular prose, and then they would have a long poem or a short poem and more prose and songs. It was strange.
That's fascinating, especially when you bring in like the translation element of it, you know, and how that changes things. Speaking of like these Chinese epics, did you find yourself turning to them during the writing of, or have you been reading them a long time and it's just...
No, actually, I think most of them I read afterwards. So the one, I mean, a book that did have some influence on me and that is Asian and is translated and is a real classic, but it's not Chinese, is The Tale of Genji by Murasaki Shikibu. I don't know how to pronounce that name correctly. But I read that as a child, not an especially young child. You know, I was over 10, maybe over 13. But that contained some short bits of poetry. And as a child, the short bits of poetry were my favorite bit in the book in translation. I still loved them, but the Chinese classics I came to later.
Interesting. So now that The Sign of the Dragon is published out in the world, and it's won an award, Do you have any thoughts of returning to this world, or does this kind of feel complete as is?
I feel like I probably will not continue the story. I feel like if I were going to re-enter the world and write more, I mean, I could imagine, and I have occasionally toyed with writing one or two extra poems that aren't in the book, and, you know, either just submitting them individually or just thinking to myself, ah, well, you know, that was another poem that could have been in the book. But if I was going to write a lengthy chunk, I think I would go ahead and make it a prequel that happened hundreds of years before. I don't think I want, yes, I mean, that people have suggested that I could write about Zhao's son, but I don't think I want to do that. And I'm not sure I would return to it at all. I think it's doubtful. But if I did, I think it's more likely that I would write a prequel and the dragon would still be in it as a minor but important character shaping some other event.
Yeah, interesting. I don't, for some reason, this made me think, because so this started out with one poem and then turned into this huge epic thing. Do you find yourself now going, like, as you're writing a new poem, you're like, oh no, could this turn into some bigger thing?
I do find myself wondering whether poems could turn into projects. So for instance, I wrote the book before this is Elemental Haiku, and it's very, very much shorter. It's 119 haiku for the elements of the periodic table. And there again, I wrote the first two haiku on a whim one morning, and then it occurred to me I had done hydrogen and helium and I could just attempt to work my way through the periodic table. So I do have, given that both those books began with me just thinking I was in an idle moment writing a poem or possibly two haiku, and then became a much longer project, I do wonder whether things will be longer. And I do have groups of poems. So, you know, at the moment I have a short set of poems that are all called What Something Reads, you know, What Aliens Read or whatever. And I keep adding to it, but I don't think that that will ever be long enough to be a book in itself. I do have a much longer set of astronomy poems, most of which begin with, have the title How to Something, like How to Surprise Saturn, or How to Decorate the Moon, or How to Fathom a Light Year. And there they have reached a bookish length, and my agent is submitting them, so I don't know whether anything will come of it. But I have published individual poems from it, although now I've stopped submitting them while she tries to sell the collection. Yeah, but yes, as far as a longer narrative one, the closest I've come is to think about the kinds of things I might like to write about. But it's very different. And I think it's actually quite hard for me to do it by thinking, oh, I would like to write a poem in which the main characters are older women who did something exciting in their youth, but this is later in their lives and probably they'll get dragged into something, but they had stopped, you know, being warriors or whatever they were. And I don't know. It's more something I would like to write than that something that I have any specific anchor into. So I think it's more likely that I would actually, something random would happen and I'd end up writing a book about whales, you know, swimming in the ocean without ever having thought that I was going to write a book about whales. It would just happen that I got particularly invested in one whale and then I wanted to know more about it. There won't be a whale book, but I mean, I think it's more likely to be a random project than one that I try to calculate in advance.
Got you. Well, I hope your astronomy book finds a home. And if you ever get inspired to write the older women book, that sounds amazing too.
Thank you.
So to wrap things up, I would love to know if there is something you're reading or some form of media that you're loving or finding inspiring right now.
There Okay. Okay. Let's see. So the last book that I read that I would feel I could say to anyone, oh, this is a book I loved and it's great, is The Empress of Salt and Fortune. I'm going to say her name is Nige Vo. I don't know how to pronounce her name. The last name is V-O. And it's a novella. And I thought it was brilliant. But I, in terms of what I read for fun, at the moment, something about the world at the moment means that I'm trying to escape into something that will last a long time. So I've been looking for series that I can disappear into. And normally I want them to have a main character, or ideally several main characters, who I'm going to like and be able to root for. And so there have been a bunch of them that I've fallen for during the pandemic. C.J. Cherry has some books from the past. I reread the Channel books, which are science fiction. And then I discovered that she had another science fiction series called Foreigner, which I loved. And I loved Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London, which is urban fantasy. I love, and during the pandemic, read the most recent book in Megan Whalen-Turner's series, The Thief, which appears to be marketed for young adults, though it contains some very dark material in it. So I'm not sure. I mean, I read dark material when I was a young adult, but I'm not sure every parent would be comfortable with their child reading it. Right now, the one that I'm going through is a series by Stephen Brust, which she began in the 1980s, though I think the most recent book, which I haven't yet reached, is from 2017, and it's about a character called Vlad Taltos, who's an assassin. I just find a thing and I want to be able to read it and read it and read it, and it take a while till I get till the end. That's something specific to the last couple of years that I find myself wishing to do that.
Awesome. It sounds like some fun epic journeys to take in the reading world. Great. Yeah. So is there somewhere that people can find you online?
Yes. I have a very imaginative website, which is called marysoonlee.com. And my very imaginative Twitter handle is @MarySoonLee. And that's it. I don't do Facebook. Those are my, I do review books on Goodreads. So as I make my way through series after series or standalone books, I write my comments online. And yes.
Great. Thank you so much for joining this conversation.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for listening. This is New Books and Poetry, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.